From Austin Film Festival, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading creators, writers, and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Academy Award-winning writer Kevin Wilmot joined us for an in-depth conversation on balancing messages of social justice with entertainment. His filmography includes collaborations with filmmaker Spike Lee on Five Bloods, Chi-Raq, and Black Klansman, which won the Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay in 2019. Greg Garrett spoke with Wilmot at the virtual Austin Film Festival. Clips of Five Bloods, courtesy of Netflix, and 40 Acres and a Mule Filmworks. Clips of Destination Planet Negro, courtesy of Candy Factory Films. Clips of Black Klansman, courtesy of Focus Features, Universal Pictures Home Entertainment, and 40 Acres and a Mule Filmworks. Clips of the 24th, courtesy of New Slate Ventures and Vertical Entertainment.
At the opening of Kevin's new film, 24th, the camera pans across the faces of men of the 24th Infantry Division, Black soldiers who in Houston, Texas in 1917 fought back against white violence and ended up on trial for their lives.
When I aim the gun, oh, God, help me. Oh, help me. I saw a man. I saw a man. And you know the thing? He didn't see one back. Don't stay unheard forever. You keep pushing people down. Sooner or later, they rise up.
It's a beautiful film, a powerful film, historical, yet contemporary. And it is very much of a piece with the other work that Kevin has done as writer, director, and actor on his own films, which includes CSA, Confederate States of America, and The Only Good Indian. And as the writing partner to Spike Lee on Chi-Raq, Black Klansman, and Five Bloods. You were born in Kansas. You came back to Kansas after doing your academic training. How do you make that work as a filmmaker? What are the good parts about being based someplace other than Hollywood?
Well, something I kind of learned from Spike, actually. This is before I was working with him. You know, Spike had done, She's Gotta Have It, and, you know, that launched a lot of folks in my generation. It launched a lot of us, you know, wanting to be filmmakers. And one of the things I picked up from him was that you had to kind of go where people knew you. That's why I kind of went back home to make my first film. I wasn't getting anything happening for me back in New York. I didn't know anybody, you know? And so, you know, for me, it was getting back to some place that I had a base of support with. And fortunately, I was able to kind of stumble into this whole thing. And then KU asked me to teach here, and that helped me to make more of my films because they had equipment. But I didn't really necessarily plan it this way. It was how things kind of just unfolded for me.
Are there some ways that teaching feeds back into your creative process?
I love talking about, you know, we love talking about film, and then you're in a space where you are trying to explain how to write screenplays or how to evaluate race in movies and things like that. And it really is, for me, it's always kind of, I think gained from that. Every day it's a reminder of what you do and kind of why you're doing it. And with screenwriting specifically, you know, I'm talking about their stories a lot. And I kind of learn from that, I think. I mean, it makes you kind of, you know, I have to cut to the chase on things, no pun intended, but, you know, where you're trying to, you know, make someone understand what's kind of good, what's working and what's not working with their story idea, with their script. And doing that for them, I think you just learn from it yourself. It's a constant reminder of what you're trying probably to do. And so, yeah, for me, it's always just been fun.
You've taken roles in some of your films. I'm wondering if you could talk with us about what you might have learned about storytelling or structure from the acting side of things, from the other side of the camera.
You know, I did theater first, and I think theater training, I think, helps the filmmaker a great deal. I think one thing, being in plays really helps you to write dialogue. I think, you know, when people say, you know, when people struggle with dialogue, I often tell them, you should go be in plays. You should, you know, just, even if you're not like the lead, you got some two lines, you're going to be around actors, good actors doing lines and doing dialogue, and you're going to hear the rhythm of dialogue. And you don't get that a lot on a film set, really. I mean, you know, film, you know, scenes are short and they move fast. But in plays, you know, you do scenes over and over and over again, and you're there for very long periods of time rehearsing, and you learn how dialogue works, and you learn how dialogue sounds, and you can create an ear for dialogue. You know, that's I think the thing that it's one of those things that's kind of hard to teach, that ear for dialogue, that ear for good dialogue. I think that's a thing you've got to kind of develop a little bit.
One of the things that I want to talk about today is it feels to me like there are a lot of through lines with your work and Spike's work where you're doing a lot of similar things, which I'm guessing is we're going to talk about why you're so good together. But in 2009, you directed The Only Good Indian with the great Native American actor Wes Studi. It's a beautiful Western with a lot of cinematic antecedents. There's that gorgeous door frame shot right out of The Searchers. And there's a really powerful focus on the connection between racism and mythology, which is one of the things that Westerns do. The myth of the American West, the myth of white superiority over everybody else they encounter. Could you talk a little bit about what attracted you to that story and what you're proudest of now thinking about the movie these years later?
Wow, thank you for all that. Yeah, I think I love Westerns. I've always loved Westerns. Went to Westerns all the time as a kid. I still want to make Westerns. I mean, you know, I don't think enough Westerns get made still. So the genre is something I'm very close, as my kids will tell you, he's always watching the damn Western, you know? And, you know, I think the fact that it was centered in the Native American experience was important to me because here in Lawrence is one of the cities that had a boarding school. And the boarding school that's here is like the really only last existing one that has been you know, transformed into Haskell Nation's university. It's transformed from a place that took your identity to a place that now celebrates your identity. And so when you get into the story of the boarding schools and you see, you know, how they were designed to rob someone of their identity. And identity has been a big theme in almost all of my films in various ways. You know, Wes Studi has talked about how much he loves that role. And we worked hard at trying to make it a modern story and not just a story about the past, that oftentimes Native Americans in films are kind of locked in the past. And we wanted Wes's character specifically to kind of be this modern man who's really kind of from the past and has been defined by the past, but he's trying really hard, in essence, to kind of really assimilate. And the problem with that, and the difficulties with that, and the good things with that. So all of that, I thought, you know, I thought we were able to bring some interesting ideas to that and make a Native American character that you don't see every day. You know, you don't get to see every day in film. And I guess the other thing is the thing you mentioned about the mythology. That, you know, the West, and this is why I use The Searchers imagery from it, is that, you know, we grew up, you know, I grew up, our generation, and we grew up watching those movies, going to the movies to see those films. And the Western, you know, was just like, you know, McDonald's. It was just what you ate every day. It was just like, that's just what they fed us, right? And you didn't realize in them doing that to us, we were being fed a bunch of lies as well. And a bunch of myths that just, you know, were messing us up in the head, all of us. And so I like the fact that we kind of, you know, that it's an anti-Western, that it's you know, that we kind of dismantle the myth. The last image of The Searchers is John Wayne turning away from the door and being cast out into the world to kind of be lost, really, in a sense, I think. And in our film, you know, Wes Studi is invited inside the door and he's brought into the community. And he's been lost before, but now he's found. And he's been brought back to being a Cherokee and part of the tribe and part of the people, and he's home, really. One of the things I learned from blaxploitation movies as a kid is that when you haven't seen yourself in positive imagery very often, you don't want to be lied to, but you do want to feel like you get to win sometimes. You want to win when it's been set up in an honest and appropriate kind of story. You don't want to win just for the sake of winning, but you do want to win after a hard-fought battle that you believe in, and it's the right ending. And that's how I felt about The Only Good Ending, that was the right ending for that film.
The other film that I want to ask you about before we sort of turn to some of the Spike Lee films and then talk about 24th, I was really intrigued by Destination Planet Negro. That's your 2013 social comedy about how black people in 1939 attempted to escape the racist society here in America by colonizing Mars. And it's smart and it's funny and it's very political. How do you balance the points you want to make and the story you want to tell?
You know, with Destination, for instance, as kind of with CSA, you know, there's a clear reason kind of why I want to make the film. I mean, the film has an agenda. It has a clear, defined kind of point to it. With Destination, it was, you know, it was really kind of a reflection on my parents in many ways because, you know, I was raised by older people. My father was born in 1898. He was 60 when I was born. And my parents were just older and their friends were older. And so I grew up around older people. And so I heard a lot about the old days, you know, growing up, you know, the old days in the 1920s and the 1930s and all of that stuff. And so when Obama became president, I mean, we never thought there would ever be a black president. And the joke was always, you know, if someone became president, they'd kill him like the next day. And so my parents, they in their wildest dreams could have never imagined there would ever be a black president in the United States. And so when Obama became president, I always had this idea about black people going to Mars or someplace to get out of the problem. But when Obama became president, it was like I wanted to kind of explore how far we've come and how far we still need to go.
We have civil rights now, sir. Martin Luther King had a dream, and he gave us civil rights. Are you aware that we have a black president now? And he's half white, too. You can't treat us like this.
Yeah, and not only is the president one of us, but so is the biggest TV and movie stars, the biggest basketball and football players, even the biggest professional golfer.
Yeah, 5-0. And his wife is from Sweden. From Sweden! And he f***ed a bunch more on the side, all of them white.
And so it seemed like the perfect vehicle to kind of do that. And so to me, it's always been, the effort is always to try to make the joke. The joke is also about the point. The joke is always, you know, about what you're trying to unfold, what you're trying to expose, what you're trying to satire, what you're trying to, you know, reveal. And, you know, for that film, I mean, there's a lot of sci-fi jokes and old 50s, you know, movies jokes. And that's when you look at something like Blazing Saddles, I mean, he's got a lot of, Mel Brooks has a lot of jokes like that in it, too. Besides the racial jokes, there's those jokes as well. And so those are just, you know, you create a world and you have fun with it. But the jokes that matter are the ones where you get to kind of use this genre to kind of stick the audience and say, you see that, don't you? You see this. And you've got to make sure that when you're educating them, in a sense, that you're also making them laugh and that you're also making them go or something. You know, you got to get some kind of reaction out of them besides just the point. So that's something that I've always admired. I mean, that's one of the connections I think I have with Spike is that, you know, we both love Dr. Strangelove. You know, we both love, you know, those 60s and 70s satires that, you know, Network, you know, those movies that had a clear point. I'm going to take this on. I'm going to expose something here. I'm going to do it as a funny a way as I can find.
There's a lot of connectivity between the things that you do and the things that you both are passionate about. The intense mix of politics, social commentary, and storytelling, the thoughtful awareness of our film heritage. I mean, you're both, you know, totally versed in American film history and other histories as well. And we know that you've done three films together, but how did you meet? And how did you decide to start working together?
I met Spike just very briefly when She's Got a Habit was coming out. You know, he went to NYU. He was there a couple years before I was. And he actually was dating a girl in the dorm I was in at NYU. He would come through occasionally, and he didn't know me from Adam, and I didn't even try to put the whammy on him or anything. So it really was my film CSA. So I made this film and sent it to my agent at the time, and he said, Spike was in the office, he heard about your film, you know, he'd like to see it. And I said, yeah, let him see it. And so Spike checked it out, and he called me and said, I really love your film. I like to support you in some kind of way with the film. So it was presented by Spike Lee. And one of the things I tell my students is that, you know, when you get a break, you got to kind of be ready for your break. You know, so the first thing he asked me was, do you have anything else? And I had another script at that time. It was called Gotta Give It Up. And it was about, it was the Liz Estrada story that would later become Chi-Raq. And so, you know, we spent about 6-7 months together trying to get Gotta Give It Up made. At that time, it was called Gotta Give It Up. But when, you know, we had, you know, several readings for different studios and just spent some time together trying to make all that happen. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. And he went on to his thing. I went on back to my thing. And so literally 15 years later, I get a call from him. And he says, do you still have that script? I said, yeah, I still got it, man. And he said, let's set it in Chicago and call it Chi-Raq. And it became the first film for Amazon Studios. And so you never know about these things, right? You never know. And then from there, you know, I think we worked well together. And he called me about Black Klansman. And, you know, we immediately kind of got into that. And then he gave me another call on Five Bloods. And so, you know, I think that it's kind of been an unspoken kind of partnership. A big part of it is also the projects that he's approached me with. Those were all three films. Obviously, the Chi-Raq was kind of my start, my idea, but he was automatically interested in it for the same reasons I was interested in it. And I think also that we believe that film can make things better. You know, I think both of us believe that. I mean, you know, I'm a big fan of the problem pictures. You know, that's what Donald Bogle calls them, the films of the late 40s and 50s and 60s that helped the civil rights movement. You know, Sidney Poitier movies, all those things. For me, film taught me a lot about race, and it taught me a lot about America, American history, and good and bad. And so, you know, I just think that film can make the world a better place. And I think he believes that too. And I think he kind of feels that, as I do, that, you know, there's a responsibility there. I mean, your first responsibility is to entertain and all that. But there's also, you know, you're not supposed to be making dumb movies. You know?
It sort of feels like to me that in Chi-Raq and in Black Klansman and The Five Bloods, like you are like using every arrow in your quiver, so to speak, on whatever the problem might be that you're wrestling with in that film. So let's move, if we could, to Black Klansman, which is one of my favorite films of the last 30 years. I've got kind of an interesting angle in on this because a couple of years ago, my Baylor students and I here at the festival had a chance to talk with David Rabinowitz about his and Charlie's work, you know, the initial work that they did in adapting this from Ron Stallworth's memoir.
Well, I think what Charlie and David did was they really did a great job of kind of laying it out. You know, I mean, the key relationship was there, you know, and I think that's Flip and Ron's character. And also there was a love interest that we kind of, you know, redeveloped in various ways. You know, I think in creating Flip, making Flip Jewish, it really kind of took what we kind of saw as the controlling idea, which was really Tunis. Tunis is that thing that W.B. Du Bois talked about. Tunis is the struggle between being a Black American and an American. And there's a lot of different levels of Tunis in the movie. So, you know, the fact that Flip is Jewish and he's a policeman. He's Jewish, but he's also an American. And the fact that, and what we kind of did with Flip was we made Flip, you know, kind of disconnected with his Jewish self.
We can't quit till we get our share.
Brother, we can't quit till we get our share. Doesn't make grammatical sense, but okay.
Say it loud. I'm black and I'm proud.
Say it for OJ, Jimmy. You too.
Say it loud. I'm black and I'm proud. Say it loud. I'm black and I'm proud. That's right. There it is. I believed you.
Lose that Jewish necklace around your neck.
Jimmy, it's not a Jewish necklace. It's a Star of David. Okay.
Flip, you're Jewish?
I don't know. Am I?
And that's that thing about identity that I've talked about before, that's a big part of some of the things that I think Spike and I are both interested in. I'm so automatically kind of started to bend it that way some. And then there's the thing, the two-ness of being black and being blue, being a black and being a policeman. And I think Spike was really interested in that as well, you know, that with the love interest in the film, that making her kind of like, the Black Student Union, almost like a Black Panther, almost really. That she's against him being a cop. And so he's got to hide, and he's hiding the fact that he's a cop for several different reasons, you know, and he can't be honest with her. And it's because of Tunis, really. It's because that, as she says several times in early in their relationship, we see the cops jack her up and exploit her. And black people have a very difficult relationship with the police. So all those levels of Tunis is kind of what immediately kind of came, I think, to Spike and I. And so we tried to infuse all that in as many ways as we could in the film.
That's a brilliant, like, parallel thing that I had not thought about until you mentioned it. And I'm sure that you guys had talked about that, but just that idea that each of them has a secret that imperils relationships in the film.
I mean, here's Flip, and he's around all these anti-Semitic guys, and here's Ron, he's on the phone literally with David Duke, you know, and he's pretending to be a Klansman. And in the reality of that is there's one of the scenes in the film is something that I experienced as a kid. And I think it's something that many people from my generation experience as kids. And, you know, I went over a buddy of mine's house after school, white buddy. And, you know, you're playing with him. I think I was in fourth grade. You're playing with him. His mother comes home. She says, "Is that here again?" And my friend looks at me, I look at him. I'm feeling sorry for him because I see how bad he feels really about it.
Right.
And so there's a scene where Ron is talking to David Duke and he's telling him that story, but he's pretending that he literally flips it and he's pretending to be the white guy and the black friend, and his father comes home and says, "You know, get the N out of here." And of course, you know, David Duke says, "Your father sounds like a great guy."
I knew it once.
Did you?
Yeah. That lived across the street from us. I must have been 6 or 7. And his nickname was Butter Biscuit.
How'd he get that nickname?
He loved his mama's butter biscuits.
Yum, yum.
Me and Butter Biscuit play together every day. One day, my father came home early from work. He told me I couldn't play with that little anymore because I was white and Butter Biscuit was a.
It's so rich.
Well, your father sounds like a terrific man.
You see on Ron's face that pain that even, you know, all these many years later, He's sharing something that happened with him that, you know, he never says it's true. He's telling it like a story, but you can tell it actually probably did happen to him.
Yeah, so that's the biscuit story.
Yes, that's the biscuit story. Yes.
And it is, yeah, so poignant.
Yeah, I mean, and so, you know, that whole convention of things allowed us to kind of, you know, bend things in so many different ways toward the multi-levels of how race works in our society and how racism works in our society.
Who did you guys make this film for? I mean, when you thought about who is going to get what were some of the things that went into your process and your planning?
Well, that's a good one. I don't think I've ever been asked that one yet. I don't think we talked about it, to be honest with you. I always look at it like this. I don't know how Spike, I can't speak for Spike here, but I always looked at it like, I think that Spike's audience, as much as it is black people, a lot of his audience is a lot of middle-aged, hip, white people. Yeah, and I think that may be actually more than even his black audience in some ways. I mean, you know, I think the black audience, we kind of take for granted to some degree. I mean, it's like, you know, I told him, I said, you know, early on we were talking about the notion of this movie. I said, you know, Spike Lee's Black Klansman, I think that sounds pretty good, man. you know, so I think that there's a part of it that you always have to, you know, because it is a black, it's kind of ultimately a black story in some ways. You kind of hope you're speaking to the black audience. You kind of put that in the pocket a little bit. But I think everyone else, you know, you're hoping that you can make a universal enough story that it can speak to just about everybody else in some way or another. You know, Spike is always talking about trying to make the past present today. And so even though, you know, it's a 70s movie, but it's in the 70s, a long time ago, really. And so we wanted it to be, to really speak to today. So we were always looking for anything that made it really current, made it. And, you know, obviously the guy in the Oval Office, we didn't have to try very hard. I mean, it was just so, right, everything was happening. And the joke I always say is that you know, David Duke and Donald Trump wrote themselves into the movie in the end.
You had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent.
Nazis go home!
Not all of those people were neo-Nazis, believe me. Not all of those people were white supremacists. But you also had people that were very fine people.
Because I believe that today in Charlottesville, this is a first step toward making a realization of something that Trump alluded to earlier in the campaign, which is, this is the first step toward taking America back.
I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the use of film history and the ways that you used it in Black Klansman. That amazing sequence at the end where you're doing that D.W. Griffith cross-cutting back and forth between the Klan meeting where they're watching Birth of a Nation and the Black Student Union.
Was so powerful, they gave the Ku Klux Klan a rebirth.
Oh my God! Oh my God! No! No! Oh, look at that one! Oh, he's disgusting! Oh! Oh, those poor women! Don't you do it!
Today they'd call that kind of movie a blockbuster. Everybody saw it.
How much did you imagine that your audience needed to know?
The big difficulty with the script was that Ron Stallworth was a really good detective. And there was really no third act. I mean, there was really, you know, there just was no third act. I mean, in real life, they wanted to blow a gay nightclub up, and he was able to thwart that attempt. So I knew kind of going in, I had to create a third act, really. That was one of the problems of the original script, really. With no fault of David and, you know, those guys. I mean, it was just, there was nothing from the book there. And so we knew we wanted to do the Klan initiation thing, and we knew that we had to create a really climax to the film in terms of the bad guys, you know, what are they trying to do? And it just seemed like them watching Birth of a Nation was in Ron's book. I mean, the Klan loves Birth of a Nation, so we didn't have to really make that up. That was part of the book. That was all part of who the Klan really is. Yeah. So we took all that, and then it was really, you know, I felt like we had to find something else to juxtaposition it with and also create what the Klan's goal, who are they going to try to blow up? And so it needed to be the Black Student Union. And I just felt like we needed to take it to another step, really another level. So having an actual witness of a lynching come in, and which is what the Klan is and what the Klan does and what the Klan did, it just kind of made all of that glue itself together. You know, so I needed to raise the stakes for the end. I needed to give it a climax. I needed to give it a big payoff. But you didn't want it to be foreign from what the whole movie is about. And I knew the story about the Waco lynching, and I knew about the excursion trains and all the levels of horror that went along with it. And I just imagined somebody witnessing that and then sharing that story with those students there. And I knew that person would have to be an older person. And so I think Spike just, I think, immediately dug that. I think that's the way to make social points without making social points. You know, that's the way to, if you can infuse it within the drama itself as much as you can, then it's not overt. You know, it's not me making a comment. It's not Spike saying something. It's just what it is.
So I've got a question about Five Bloods. I remember that critic Charlotte O'Sullivan wrote about Five Bloods that while all the characters are damaged, Paul, that's Delroy Lindo's character, Paul's prejudice and self-loathing and greed are what drive the movie. I wonder if you could talk with us a little bit about writing Paul and the other characters, and maybe even in a more universal way about the idea of brokenness as a way of creating really powerful and compelling characters.
You know, with Paul, it really started with Danny and Paul DeMaio. They made Paul's character, you know, he was kind of a racist. This is when the movie was really four white guys and one black guy. And Paul's character was, it was a jerk, and he had a son, and, you know, the it was all there, really. And so when what Spike and we always joke about it, we kind of say we just kind of blackified it. We just kind of, you know, kind of came in and put the black whammy on it. But also what we did was kind of take Paul, you know, when you thought of Paul as being black, it kind of added another level of brokenness to his character. And that's why we also made him, you know, a MAGA hat guy.
Yeah, when he walks in with the Trump hat on. And
yes, because I think most of those people are, many of them are like Paul. They've gotten a raw deal, and they've got grievances that I think are fair, that feel like they've been screwed around by society in various ways. Unfortunately, they end up kind of blaming the wrong people for their problems. And they get mad at the wrong people. And that's what Paul is. I mean, Paul is mad at everybody and kind of shedding responsibility himself, blaming other folks.
I was asleep. I mean, I was fast asleep, knocked out, man. God fucking woke me. I said, God, why are you waking my black up? God said to me, Paul, them keep on keeping on. I said to God did what now? God raised his voice, didn't yell. He put some bass in that heavenly voice, said to me, them Paul, they don't know. Do your thing, show you right.
He's had a raw deal. You know, his wife died in a weird, unfortunate young thing. He's had a hard road to hoe, but he's not learned forgiveness. He's not learned that everybody's road's pretty hard too. He's selfish in that sense and all of those things. And so we also really connected to Treasure of the Sierra Madre. And Spike and I watched that at his office in New York. And, you know, the Humphrey Bogart character is basically Paul. And Bogart in that film, you know, they get gold fever and they get selfish and he gets crazy and he turns into, you know, just a kind of a rotten guy. The thing with Paul, though, that's different than Bogart is that Paul, you know, loses his mind and goes crazy and does a lot of bad things. But in the end, you still kind of like him and you kind of understand him. And that was the thing that I think is interesting about brokenness. I think we've all, you get our age and you've met a lot of broken people and you've seen people break, and you've been involved with people breaking sometimes, you know? Most of the time, you don't get a moment like you get in the film where you get to address your brokenness at its kind of major source, and you get to reconcile with that brokenness. Most of us don't get that. That's one of the cool things movies can do. The more we made Paul broken, the more interesting he became, and the more it led to the where it leads in the film. You know, that moment in the film where he finally gets to address it. And I think then you kind of understand everything about Paul from there. And I think that's why we're able to kind of, because he's forgiven in the film, then we forgive him in the film. And that's the thing about, I grew up with a lot of broken people. And I think the older you get, the easier it is to forgive them.
On Story is part of a growing number of programs in Austin Film Festival's On Story project, including the On Story PBS series, radio program, podcast, book series, and archive, accessible through the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. To find out more about On Story and Austin Film Festival, visit onstory.tv or austinfilmfestival.com. On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, and the National Endowment for the Arts, on the web at arts.gov. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software. Find out more information about Final Draft at finaldraft.com. This podcast is supported in part by Too Far Media, immersive story experience by Rich Shapiro. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan, and Katie Turner. Our associate producers are Colin Heyer and Maya Perez. Our editors are Jamal Knox and Travis Neely. Audio capture by Travis Kennedy. Music is by Brian Ramos. Production assistance comes from Sound Lab, Inc., Travis Kennedy, and KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference each October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.